Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Andrew Kimbrell. Andrew Kimbrell is a public interest attorney and the founder and director of the 400,000-member Center for Food Safety. Andrew's also director of the Center for Technology Assessment, co-founder of Foundation Earth, and president of the board of Humane Farm Animal Care, which is the organization that administers the certified humane label. As an attorney, Andrew has led numerous historic and precedent-setting legal cases, including the court challenge that resulted in a U.S. Supreme Court victory, forcing for the first time EPA regulation of greenhouse gases and their impact on climate change. Andrew also pioneered the legal strategy that led to the Supreme Court ruling that DNA is not patentable due to being a product of nature. Andrew is the author of several books, including Fatal Harvest, The Tragedy of Industrial Agriculture. He's a leader in the fight to protect people, animals, and the environment, and to ensure that we have a safe and sustainable food supply. So now, Andrew, we are so grateful for this time with you. And now for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, for that introduction. And thank you, Andy, for being with us.
Oh, it's so great to be with you again, both of you.
It galls me, honestly. It galls many of our listeners, I'm sure, also, to see agrochemical corporations and junk food companies teaming up to spend tens of millions of dollars to fight GMO labeling bills, which have the effect of keeping us uninformed and eating in the dark. I know that you and the Center for Food Safety are in an alliance with Ocean and myself and the Food Revolution Network, working very hard to get a mandatory labeling bill passed at the federal level. In fact, your petition to the FDA, which the Food Revolution Network has also supported, has generated more than 1.4 million signatures now calling for GMO labeling in the United States. What I want to ask you, Andy, is why is GMO labeling important to you, and why should it be important to our listeners?
Well, I mean, I think it's critical that all of us more and more know what is in the food we're eating and feeding our families and our communities. And this is especially true with a technology such as genetic engineering. And without getting too technical, John, the whole point of genetic engineering is to put novel proteins into food, proteins that weren't there before. These could be proteins that would help a tomato survive in freezing temperatures or allows corn or soy to survive massive dosings of herbicides that would normally kill them. These are all new proteins in the food. And we know a little over 10 years ago there was a Starlink corn, and that was genetically engineered proteins in there that the EPA determined could well have an allergenic effect, cause, you know, allergies in people, and it led to one of the largest recalls in American food history. So these are novel proteins. They have never been in foods before. The companies have patented them and patented the bacteria and the viral genes that are in these foods. And so this is completely novel material in our foods that at a minimum we have a right to know. Now, I want to make a quick distinction, which is that some people say, well, if it hasn't been proven that they're dangerous, why should we label them? If it's proven that these foods are dangerous, we're not going to label them. We're going to take them off the shelves. All the labels we see in our grocery stores, they're not there because the FDA thinks all those ingredients are dangerous, though some of us think they are. They just say, hey, this is something in the food you would not know unless it was labeled, something novel and something new. So it is unconscionable. It is incoherent legally that here is a technology which is devoted to putting new and novel proteins in your food, some of which have already shown to cause allergies or other problems, and not let us know. There's no way an average consumer can say, aha, here is sweet corn that is genetically engineered. Here is sweet corn that is not. There's no way you can see that visually. So the only way they're going to know is through labeling. And they have a right to know that those novel proteins, never seen in foods before, they have a right to know that they're in those foods.
Well, it's a good point you make that if we had proven these foods to be dangerous, we'd take them off the shelves. We would ban their sale. We're wanting labeling so consumers can have the right to know.
Exactly. And that's often a confusion. And if we were to find that some or all of these foods would be dangerous, they'd be taken off the shelves. Right now, what we do know is they contain novel proteins, novel elements, novel viral and bacterial genes, and antibiotic-resistant genes that have purposely been put in every cell of these foods, and we have the right to know whether we're buying foods that have all that novel material in them or not.
When you talk about novel proteins, I'm remembering something that the astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson said. He is the host of the television series Cosmos, a space-time odyssey. And I have great appreciation for his work in that area, his explanations of how the laws of physics and chemistry explain the birth, life, and death of stars and planets and galaxies have inspired millions of people, including me. But even a brilliant astrophysicist like Neil deGrasse Tyson may not always be on solid ground when he speaks about a topic outside of his expertise. And I want to quote something to you that he said at some length and ask you how you would respond to him. He said, "The objection to genetically modified food reflects the fear factor that exists with every new emerging science. Because people don't fully understand what the consequences are, they reject it. But practically every food you buy in a store is genetically modified food. There are no wild, seedless watermelons. You can make a list of all the fruits and vegetables people eat and ask yourself, is there a wild counterpart to this? If there is, it's not as large, it's not as sweet, it's not as juicy, and it has many more seeds in it. We have been systematically genetically modifying all the foods that we've eaten ever since we began cultivating them. It's called artificial selection. That is how we genetically modify them. So now we can do it in a lab, and all of a sudden you're going to complain? We've long been creating and modifying the biology of the world to serve our needs. I don't have a problem with that, because we've been doing that for tens of thousands of years." How would you respond to that, Andy?
Yeah, this is a very familiar argument used a long time ago, not so much recently, but a long time ago by the biotech industry, and he's a little bit behind the times. But yeah, that's the beer and yeast argument. The idea is that we've been, hey, modifying beer and yeast and all these things for all these years. The major difference is that through all of what we call the land races, which is a way of just talking about the crops that have been developed by humans over the last 10,000 years, it was all done working with crops. Very much saying, okay, this crop grows a little bit better, then we're going to crossbreed with this crop, et cetera, et cetera. It was all done at the organism level. What we're doing now with genetic engineering is we're doing something at the cellular level. And not only that, we are actually crossing species boundaries, and I mean, we're basically taking animal genes and putting them into plants. We're taking bacteria genes and putting them into plants. They've even taken human genes, by the way, and put them into plants. And they do that at the cellular level. What they do is they take the gene they want. So let's say they took the gene in flounders that allows that fish to survive in very, very low freezing temperatures. And they said, what if we could put that into tomatoes? That means tomatoes, we could freeze them longer and they wouldn't fall apart. This was done and patented, by the way. And so how do they do that? How do you get flounder genes into tomatoes? Right? And this is that physicist should know this. He hasn't understood the biology. They do that by attaching it to a bacteria that invades the cell, invades the nucleus of the cell, and they've attached to that bacteria vectum, and it's actually a tumor-causing bacteria, and they attach to it that flounder DNA that they want in that tomato. So it goes into the cell, and then because the cell rejects it as basically a foreign invader, they add a cauliflower mosaic virus, viral DNA, to promote the activity of that. So this has nothing to do with traditional breeding. This is cell invasion technology. You are using a tumefaciens bacteria, a tumor-causing bacteria. You're attaching the genetic cassette you want to produce a particular protein, in this case one that would let the plant survive better in lower temperatures, and then you're adding viral promoters to promote it, and then you're adding even a marker system, antibiotic marker system, and you have no idea where it's going in the genome. That we have not yet had the precision. They don't know, oh, it's going to happen exactly in this chromosome, precisely in this particular section of DNA. They don't have that precision. It's a very sloppy technology, which is why about 99.9% of it doesn't work. That's why it takes so long for them to develop, why they've been so unsuccessful in developing any diversity of these crops at all. So that is a patented, completely new technology, cell invasion technology, in every one of those aspects. The new bacterium, the viral promoters, the novel DNA, and the antibiotic mark system, each one carries potential risks, and each one has then not been sufficiently assessed. So this has nothing to do with crossbreeding corn in the field or what people did with farm animals. Hey, that's the biggest pig. Let's mate it with another big pig. We'll get even a bigger pig. I mean, that was all done at the organism level. This is cell invasion technology and completely different. The technology bringing up new issues, new problems, new health issues, and new environmental issues. So it's just biologically uninformed, and a physicist should know better.
Well, the biotech industry has been spreading their myths, spreading beliefs that lead people to believe certain things, and they've been actively propagating those myths for quite some time. One of them that they've been telling us for years is that their genetically engineered crops would enable us to reduce pesticide use. And when people hear that, they think that's a good thing. And I think it would be if, in fact, that's what happened. But more than 80% of the genetically engineered crops they have brought us to date have been designed to withstand massive doses of toxic herbicide. And this has meant the addition of hundreds of millions of pounds of these chemicals to our farmland and to our food crops. And it has led, as you and I and others predicted it would, to weeds developing resistance to these herbicides. And now, in response to that, Monsanto and Dow and the others are bringing us new genetically engineered crops designed to be doused with even more hazardous herbicides in order to kill these resistant superweeds, as they're called. What I want to ask you is, how can this lead to any outcome other than ever higher quantities of ever more dangerous herbicides being sprayed over our food crops?
Yeah, I mean, it has been used a word before, I like galling. It's been very galling for me, and I know many of us. And they're somehow accusing us, those of us who are concerned about these crops, as being science deniers. The exact opposite is true. In 1992, when Monsanto first began creating these crops, then in 97, when they first got regulatory approval to plant them, Monsanto said in its application to the USDA that the Roundup Ready crops, these are the crops that are designed to withstand massive doses of Roundup, and as you correctly say, about 115 million more pounds of Roundup are used every year because of these crops, just really flooding the Midwest with these herbicides, that they said, don't worry, they will not cause resistance in weeds. Weeds won't become resistant. They won't adapt and become resistant. And then Bob Fraley specifically said that in congressional testimony. He said, don't worry, there will be no super weeds. Well, this is called adaptation. It's microevolution. It's taught in the third grade here in Washington, D.C. Third grade. That's third grade science. That when you create an environment that is hostile to a particular organism, over a period of time, some of those organisms will develop resistance to it, and those are the ones that will survive, and those are the ones that will propagate. Just basic biology. And so it was Monsanto and Monsanto's enablers at the USDA and the other federal agencies who are the science deniers. They denied that there would even be superweeds. Today, we have these weeds, these superweeds that are resistant to Roundup, and it's active ingredient glyphosate, and up to 50%, and that's the industry's own figures, 50% of America's farmlands. And these are pigweeds that can grow 6-7 feet tall. They have the thickness of a baseball bat, and they grow so closely together you'll destroy your combine if you try and get rid of them. There's weed scientists around the country, mainstream weed scientists who've never spoken out before on this technology, who are terrified, who are calling it a potential catastrophe for American agriculture. But guess what? As you said, John, instead of saying, uh-oh, terrible mistake, we were the science deniers, it's causing a catastrophic problem and more worse and worse problem in the American farmlands, instead of saying, let's pull back and use integrated weed management, which we know can reduce herbicides by 90%, oh no, they're going the next step. So Dow has come in with its 2,4-D resistant crops, which now Monsanto has taken over, so you can stack that trait with the Roundup trait. It's called Duo Enlist. I love that military sounding, by the way. Duo Enlist, kill all the weeds.
I understand why you feel indignant and alarmed, Andy. What you're describing is enraging. I feel it too, and I'm sure many of our listeners are also deeply concerned about these developments.
You mentioned the fact that these names sound military. That's actually not entirely an accident. Dow and Monsanto have, as you've mentioned, now genetically engineered crops to be resistant to the herbicide 2,4-D. Our listeners might not know that 2,4-D, along with a related compound, 2,4,5-T, make up the chemical warfare agent known as Agent Orange. So with the introduction of these crops, we will literally be spraying our fields with massive amounts of a chemical, 2,4-D, that is part of Agent Orange. And the amounts will be massive. I've seen peer-reviewed scientific papers that say we'll be looking at an increase of more than a billion more pounds of this toxic chemical. The chemical companies have been telling us not to worry. As you mentioned, they've been telling us that the weeds would not develop resistance to glyphosate, but the weeds have developed resistance and have in fact become superweeds. Now the chemical companies have been telling us that glyphosate and Roundup are safe, but in March of this year, an agency of the World Health Organization issued a report concluding that glyphosate, the key ingredient in Monsanto's Roundup, likely causes cancer in humans. It's all so very sad, particularly when we could, as you aptly described, take a different approach. We could get off the pesticide treadmill. We could start using organic approaches and agroecological methods instead of ever more chemicals. But that wouldn't be profitable for the chemical companies, so that hasn't been the direction we've taken. It's really so sad, and at times frightening. It can be hard to face. But the truth is that only if we face it can we do something about it. And that is why, as hard as this information is to take in, I'm really grateful to you, Andy. And now I want to ask you, what are we going to see if we don't change directions? What are we going to see if we continue to allow Monsanto and the other chemical companies to dictate agricultural policy? What specifically is that going to mean down the line?
Well, that's going to mean very, very serious 15 years from now, not only all the contamination and all the cancers and Parkinson's and all the other diseases associated with 2,4-D and dicamba and Roundup, the birth defects among farm workers, all these things will be happening, but also we will have weeds in 30, 40, 50, 60% of America's farmland that will be almost impossible to get rid of. And so what's going to happen is they're going to have to do massive tillage, right, so till up the weeds, so they'll be destroyed, which will be releasing a huge amount of carbon and, among other things, increasing climate change. So by these science deniers, Monsanto and the other biotechnology companies and our USDA, they are the science deniers and sending us down a catastrophic path that can only lead to massive infestation of superweeds that you cannot get rid of and that will have enormous health impacts on consumers, on farmers, and increased climate change. So they're the science deniers. We need to be very firm and strong and make sure that we push back very hard on these superficial claims that somehow we're the science deniers. As I said, they would fail a third-grade science class here in Washington, D.C.
Well, I agree we have to push back on that because the idea that questioning GMO technology, wanting labeling, wanting legitimate testing of these crops before they're planted in our fields is anti-science. That idea has some pull in our culture, and we have to fight against it. And meanwhile, Monsanto has come up with these dicamba-resistant crops, and Monsanto has petitioned the EPA, I believe, to increase the tolerance level of dicamba allowed on these crops 150-fold.
Well, that's right. They've had to do it with Roundup. They've had to do it with 2,4-D, and now they're doing it with dicamba. They have to do this, right, because, you know, those tolerance levels were based on prior agricultural practices. Now they're going to be absolutely flooding these fields with these herbicides, and so, of course, there's going to be much more residue on the crops and in our food. And, you know, as folks I'm sure know that are listening, this has also led to numerous unintended consequences, one of which is the destruction of about 98% of our milkweed in the Midwest, which is right on the flight path of monarchs and many other insects. But monarchs, because they're iconic, are sort of the canary in the cornfield, if you will, because they need those milkweeds because it's a multi-generational migration that monarchs take from the south all the way through to Mexico, and they go through the Midwest, and they're dying off in huge numbers, the monarchs, massive numbers, because there's no milkweed for them to feed on and to reproduce on. So the use of herbicides is so massive that it's killing everything, the milkweeds, flowering plants, anything that's green in these areas. It's creating a death zone. And there's a lot of collateral damage that's happening because of it. So one other quick point I wanted to make on labeling, which is, you know, people always ask me, John, they say, how come Monsanto and the Biotechnology Industrial Organization and all those folks have spent $50 million to stop labeling in California? They won by just a little over 1%. Same in Washington. They only won by a little over 800 votes out of over 1.5 million cast in the most recent Oregon ballot initiative after spending around $20 million. So why are they spending that money? And here's the reason. They're spending all that money because they have failed to come up with any major product that does anything for the public or for the consumer out there, right? Now, there's no better nutrition. There's no better taste. There's no less toxins. There's nothing. They have not created anything for the consumer that benefits the consumer, only risk. So for a, you know, normal consumer, if they see something that's labeled GMOs and one that is not, they're going to pick the one that's not because same price, no advantage to the GMO and only risk. So in a way, the entire technology and all of these companies have succeeded in selling their chemicals and their seeds that can withstand these chemicals, but they have completely failed in any market sense to provide an advantage to a consumer. Normally, if you have a product, and particularly a food product, and you're putting it out to the public, you say, hey, better taste, right? More nutrition, less fat. You have something to advertise, but they don't. They're just interested in selling their chemicals, which have no advantage to the consumer at all. So they know if the consumer can become informed, they will say, oh, this doesn't offer me any advantages, only offers me some risk, and we can disagree on the risk, but some risk. And why would they buy it? Same price, no advantage, only risk. So it's really, labeling would advertise the complete failure of the biotechnology industry to come up with foods that would attract consumers or any kind of trait in foods that would attract consumers, and that's why they're so afraid of labeling. They realize that no one would buy their product.
Well, here's what I'm seeing. GMO crops do not increase yield potential. GMO crops increase pesticide use. GMO crops have created super weeds. GMO crops have toxic and allergenic effects on lab animals. And this leads me to the conclusion that GMO crops are not about feeding the world, as the biotech industry propaganda and advertising and marketing would have us believe, but actually are about patented ownership of the food supply. Andy, do you think my conclusion is overreaching, or is it justified?
Well, I think it's justified. I'd go a step back. I'd say let's remember who we're talking about here. Let's remember that the five major companies are Monsanto, Dow, DuPont, Syngenta, and Bayer. And you can throw BASF and a couple of others in. Those are all chemical companies. What they're most interested in doing is selling, you know, wait for it, chemicals. They're chemical companies. They've never been about feeding the world. They're not the United Nations. You know, they're not even USAID that unfortunately pushes this stuff. No, they're chemical companies who've invented, and you have to give them credit, by luck, a little bit, but it's also pretty ingenious, a technology that allows them to sell many, many more of their chemicals. And yes, sooner or later they'll be useless, but meanwhile they'll have sold billions and billions and billions of dollars of these chemicals. And they've patented, using this technology, they have opened the door to patenting the genetic resources of all the plants of the world. This is going to be a huge, huge failure, right? I mean, genetic engineering, which we've explained, you know, with dicamba and 2,4-D, 10, 15 years from now, they won't be useful anymore. So the plan B of Monsanto and Dow and DuPont is to begin to own all the seeds of the world, not genetically engineered seeds, all the seeds. Using the money they're getting from biofuel, government subsidies, and others, Monsanto now is the largest seed owner, not genetically engineered seeds, seed owner in the world. They own over a quarter of all the world's commercial seeds. You throw two or three other of the companies I was talking about, and you're talking about 55-60% ownership of all the seeds, commercial seeds, available in the world. And so they're using this technology not only to make a lot of money, but to open the door at the patent office so they can patent, own, and ultimately have a monopoly on the seeds. And remember, when they buy up all these seeds, they don't use them all. They buy them, and that means they can discard a huge amount of them and simply limit the seeds that are available to farmers to the ones that are most profitable for them, genetically engineered or hybrid seeds that are the most profitable to these companies. So they can buy them up and get rid of them. This is one of the reasons why we're very excited this year. We've gotten some wonderful funding to start an international seed savers network, which will allow seed savers around the world to exchange seeds and exchange diversity. And will allow them to have the scientific and legal information they need to do that safely and legally. And the idea is to try and set up an entirely sort of open source alternative to the more and more monopolized corporate seed takeover, so that we can protect diversity and allow farmers, gardeners, and others around the world to have access to full diversity at, you know, either an exchange or low-cost basis. So, we're trying to begin to really establish that with a lot of partners, and I'm very excited by that, because that's the only way we're going to break their monopoly, is really sort of an open-source, bottom-up, a way of all of us who are saving seeds to be able to exchange and break their monopoly. But you're absolutely right. Ultimately, that is their goal, is to own 100% of the world's commercial seeds.
Well, when I think of them having that goal and working very diligently to reach it, what's involved is controlling the world's food supply for profit and not for the betterment of the planet or the human beings who live on it or the ecosystem. It sounds so nefarious. It reminds me of some James Bond movie where the evil villain is trying to control the world and has some technology that's going to enable them to do that, or so they hope. It really does sound almost beyond belief.
Yes, I think that, you know, as you put it so well, John, if you look at genetic engineering as kind of almost a subterfuge for them to take over the commercial seeds of the world and the food of the world, that is a really great way to understand what they're ultimately about. And the way to stop that is not just to stop genetic engineering. And remember, something like about 7% of the world's crops are genetically engineered, only 7%. And I think about 6% of the world's crops are certified organic. So it's not so much that outside of the United States, Canada, and some places in South America, genetic engineering hasn't taken root. But the real danger here, and it's a danger that is not being reported, and even some of us in the NGO movements, I don't believe, are spending enough time and energy and attention on it, is this takeover of the world's seeds, is this sort of biopiracy, by which they are going into seed libraries, they're buying up every small seed company in the world to own the germplasm, the genetics of all of the seeds of the world. That is a goal that would give them enormous power and would be much more ultimately lucrative for them than anything they're getting right now through genetic engineering. And I really thank you for bringing that up, because I think that's really something we don't, you know, pay enough attention to. So what should we do? We should fight the patenting of seeds. What should we do? We should fight, you know, with antitrust measures, any of these takeovers. And, as I was saying, on the more positive level, is we need to protect those seed libraries, because now some of them are under attack, and we need to make sure that we have an open-source seed alternative for the world. And it's really important, especially with climate change coming, because even some of the great indigenous seeds and areas, we don't know what's going to grow and where it's going to grow in the future. We don't know, with climate chaos coming, you know, where any particular seed might grow best. And we may have flood conditions where we didn't have them before. We may have drought conditions where we didn't have them before. So the more diversity of seeds, the more food security we're going to have for farmers and farm communities around the world. And the more they take over the seed, the more they monoculture those seeds, not for diversity, not to save the farmers, particularly in a climate crisis. Oh, no, they're going to develop those seeds for their bottom line, just for the ones that give them the most profit most easily. So that, well, this is a huge issue for food security and for world survival and for diversity that we need to address more and more and more.
I see labeling connected to this, because just very recently Hershey's has kissed GMOs goodbye, and they're going to make their Hershey Kisses GMO-free. They're going to use sugar that is not GMO. And they use a tremendous amount of sugar, the Hershey Company does. And it's their Kisses and some of their other product lines too, some of their big ones. And I think if they can do that and they can source non-GMO sugar, then if we get labeling and the public sees the label and turns away, companies like Pepsi and Coke that also use a tremendous amount of sugar will be inclined to go non-GMO. And this could start a wave of lack of market for these crops, the GMO crops. and might break Monsanto's momentum that they're developing in taking over the world seed supply. At least that would be my hope.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, obviously people vote with their dollars. It's very important as we do litigation, as we do legislation, that we also keep pushing the market approach. Remember, these genetically engineered crops have only been around since 1997, and many of them even more recently than that, including beets. And remember that during that period of time, we've defeated genetically engineered tomatoes, we defeated genetically engineered potatoes, we stopped genetically engineered wheat, we stopped the marketing of genetically engineered rice. For 7 years, we stopped genetically engineered alfalfa, and we're still in that fight. We stopped genetically engineered canola in the Willamette Valley. We've stopped for 12 years the introduction of genetically engineered salmon. So, you know, we have many victories, and some of those victories happen through litigation. Some of them happen, like the tomato and the potato, happen through these grassroots marketing campaigns. So we need to use all the tools at our disposal to break that momentum. We've done it in the past. We've beat them in the past, and we're seeing that momentum happening now. I mean, we are in the situation right now where I know in Hawaii, where we have our Center for Food Safety office in Honolulu, you know, we've been very glad to be part of bills on Kauai and the Big Island and Maui that have either restricted use of pesticides or banned or created a moratorium on GMOs. Now, the companies are suing to try and stop that democracy from happening. Same with Vermont. Vermont has the nation's first labeling law that's not triggered by other states, so it would come into effect. And the biotech industries have sued to stop that.
It seems we are at a pivotal moment. Where do you see us, Andy, at this point in history?
We're at a very dramatic point right now. Not only the history of food, which is so important in the future of food, but also in the future of really of democracy. And food has become, and fracking too, they've become really these the turning points here, where we're going to have counties, cities, states able to say, no, we don't want this technology. It creates super weeds. It destroys our export market, destroys our organic market. No, we don't want that. And we have the right to say, or yes, we want labeling. We have the right to know. We're going to see whether that democracy will survive or whether the corporations will be able to squelch it and destroy it. And that's the very dramatic times that we're living in right now. And everybody listening, each and every one of us needs to do everything we can to pass those bills, whether it be against GMOs, whether it be for labeling, whether it be against pesticides, whether it be against fracking, whether it be for organic agriculture. We need to get each of us, because if enough counties do it, enough states do it, they won't be able to stop it all.
Well, it is dramatic. It's extraordinarily dramatic. And that's the nature of the times that we're living in. And that's the reality that we're facing. Some people I know kind of retreat from the intensity and the immensity of what's at stake. They say, well, I'll just buy organic food and I'll take care of myself. I won't try to participate in the larger issues and the larger social and political realities. And I understand how people feel. It's hard not to shut down in the face of some of these developments. We're looking at America the Beautiful becoming America the Poisoned. And now the chemical companies have genetically engineered corn and soy plants to be resistant to dicamba. When farmers growing organic crops are in the vicinity of fields that are sprayed with dicamba, they're going to suffer a tremendous amount of collateral damage. And this raises the question whether GMO agriculture and organic agriculture can even coexist, or whether GMO agriculture, if it becomes even more widely deployed, will literally destroy organic agriculture. These really are terrifying developments to contemplate. But again, only if we face them can we respond effectively to them. Andy, can you tell us some of the ways you are responding?
Yeah, I mean, we are, Center for Safety's lawyers, we're there defending the Big Island's ban. We're there defending the Kauai pesticide bill. We're there defending the Vermont law. We're there in Jackson and Oregon through our Portland office defending that. So we used to be plaintiff lawyers, right? You know, suing the companies. Now we become defense lawyers defending the democracy of people that have taken action. But, you know, you're right. This idea of coexistence is a completely misguided, fallacious term. Coexistence isn't a political issue. Coexistence is a science issue. Have we found a way to stop genetic contamination of genetically engineered crops to organic or their conventional neighbors? Have we found a way? And the answer is no. We haven't found a way. So if you're next to a farmer who's using genetically engineered crops and that contaminates your conventional rice or your conventional corn, or organic, conventional maybe for exports, or organic for sale. You know, there's no way, we don't know how to stop that. The great contamination events that we've seen, whether it be Starlink or the rice in the South, the USDA says we have no idea how the contamination happened, and we have no idea how to stop it. So how can you have coexistence when you have no idea how to stop the contamination? Monsanto, and I just debated or had an event with Bob Fraley at Monsanto, turned it sort of into a debate, and, you know, he kept saying genetic engineering is just another tool in the toolbox. I said, no, genetic engineering is a tool that takes over all the other tools in the toolbox and makes them worthless. Dicamba especially. Dicamba, not only do you have the normal genetic drift, I mean, when you're spraying 700-800 million more pounds, which is what we're going to be seeing if we don't stop it in the next 2 or 3 years, you're going to have a huge amount of drift. That's just the wind, you know, drifting over to a neighbor's farm. And remember, these are herbicides, so whether you're conventional or organic, they'll wipe out your apple orchard, it'll wipe out your tomatoes, it'll wipe out your grapes, it'll kill anything that's green. But dicamba is even worse. Dicamba is known because it volatilizes. And by volatilization, we mean that especially in warm and moist conditions, after you spray it, catch this, after you spray it, it comes back up in a cloud. It reconstitutes itself, revolatilizes itself, and travels like a little cloud. And it can go a mile, 2 miles, and then come down again. And wherever it comes down, it'll destroy anything that's green, all the crops. Now that Roundup has become useless because of simple adaptation, I mean, simple Darwin, simple evolution, now they're having to go back to these more dangerous ones. And both conventional and organic farmers, I think, pretty soon are going to find out that this is a disastrous result, not just because of superweeds, but because of the destruction of drift and volatilization.
It occurs to me that up until 20, 25 years ago, no human being had ever eaten herbicide, had ever consumed herbicide residues in their food, because herbicides are by definition weed killers or plant killers. They disrupt photosynthesis, they kill plants, and so if you sprayed a weed killer on your crop, you'd kill the crop and it would not come to market. But with the advent of herbicide resistant crops, originally glyphosate, Roundup resistant, and now these others, we are spraying massive amounts of herbicides on food crops, and it doesn't kill the genetically engineered crop that's been designed to withstand the herbicide. So the plant must soak in into the very cells of the plant herbicide, and then those plants are food crops. We eat them. We feed them to the animals we eat, or animals whose milk we drink. And it seems to me to be a mass experiment. And yet, there's no monitoring. There's no traceability. We don't actually know what impact the fact that we're now consuming herbicides in our food is having on our health.
Yeah, you know, it took me about 5 or 6 years into this work on genetic engineered crops for me to figure that out. So you're absolutely right. And now remember, we're stacking, right? So it's not just Roundup. Roundup and 2,4-D and dicamba interacting. Again, the first line of offense, if you will, the people will be hurt, I should say, are the farmers and farm workers. They're the ones that are going to get this first. But we'll be getting it in these increased residues that you said before. And you're absolutely right. It is an experiment. It's a massive experiment. It's going to be in our water as well in massive amounts. And we haven't been subjected to that before. But behind it is also a sort of a pathology. You know, in the beginning of Silent Spring, Rachel Carson talked about this sort of pathological impulse that if something doesn't fit a particular, you know, industrial system, you try and eradicate it. You try and eliminate it. We had this very, you know, silly view that this is how we got rid of bacteria that hurt us, right? You take an antibiotic that kills all the bacteria in your body, and or many of them, most of them, and just to try and kill one. Well, that's, you know, she called it Neanderthal biology. That's her term, Neanderthal biology. And the idea that you're going to kill all these weeds, all the flowers, anything except what you want, it's not going to work. There's going to be adaptation. The weeds are going to come back. So this is Neanderthal biology. The use of these pesticides, including herbicides and insecticides, it's the wrong way to go. It will not succeed. Nature will bat last. So what we need is what's called agroecological farming, or I call it ecological farming, organic and beyond farming. And we know how to do this. You know, we've understood, people have done great work in this area. And that's where we're going to have to go. Because we've got to always remember the industrial agriculture system, it's based in oil. Well, oil is over by 2053. I mean, that's the industry's years. You know, natural gas by 2068, coal by the 2080s. So we don't have the oil. We don't have the water. Look what's happening in California. Their entire industrial system is already a dead paradigm walking. But it's a zombie paradigm. It's dead. It has no future. It will be gone within three generations. But it could so poison our land, so poison our water, so choke our land with these weeds, so destroy our soil, which it already is doing, so exhaust our aquifers, that it would take generations to recover. So our job now is to get rid of this zombie, and more substitute for it the regenerative agriculture that we know. Agriculture that regenerates soil at the pace that soil needs, regenerates water. It takes about 1,500 years for the Ogallala Aquifer to fill itself, regenerates seeds in all their diversity. That allows the regeneration of our pollinators each year. Regenerative agriculture is where we're going. It is the future. We just, all of us, have to work as hard as we possibly can to get it here as soon as possible so this zombie does not suck the life out of all of our water, our soils, monoculture our seeds, destroy our farm communities, turn the enemy sun into an enemy through climate change, destroy our pollinators, and make it so much more difficult for us to bioremediate so that we can have a regenerative system in the future. Again, a very dramatic moment, but fortunately, we know we have the tools, we have the enthusiasm, and more people, I gotta tell you, and you know this, Ocean and John, both of you know this, the growth in the food movement is so encouraging, it is so empowering, it is so amazing. If you had told me that these things were gonna be happening 20 years ago, and the communities around the country would be saying no to GMOs, and the labeling would be, you know, millions of people would be coming out to vote on that, I would have said you're out of your mind. If you told me we're going to stop all these crops, I would have said, no way. We're going to fight, but don't tell me that. So it's incredibly encouraging to see the growth of a food movement that understands where we are historically and how important it is for our future and the future of our children and grandchildren.
When I think of people in the food movement whose work I most respect and admire, Andy, I always think of you with a lot of gratitude. And I always love talking with you. It's a real joy for me, actually, to bring your message to our audience. Your voice is clear, it's passionate, it's true, and it's wise. On behalf of Ocean and myself and the entire Food Revolution Network, I thank you for being with us today, and I thank you for your ongoing dedication and commitment to a healthier food supply and a healthier world.
Well, you know, literally right back at both of you. I thank you so much for your wonderful work with the Food Revolution and everything else that you do.
Thank you, Andy. We've been talking here with the public interest attorney and Center for Food Safety founder, Andrew Kimbrell. Andy, some of what you've shared today has been frankly terrifying, but it's also been informative, galvanizing, and empowering. You are passionate, you're eloquent, you are a trusted advocate for our lives, for our planet, and for a right relation between human beings and each other and human beings and the earth. We want to thank you for your time, for your penetrating insights, for your bold leadership, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Again, thank you so much for all the work, you guys, and thank you for getting the message out. Awareness comes first, and I want to thank you so much, both of you, for doing all the work you do to increase awareness around the country. So invaluable. Thanks.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 24 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources from our speakers and partners. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thank you so much for joining us in the Food Revolution.